Hi, my name is Eileen. I am 39 for now. I'll be 40 in a few weeks. And I am here with Val, who is one of my colleagues. And we are recording this interview in a little huddle room on the floor of our office, which is located in Newark. So I think you could say hi.
Hi, I'm Valeria Momjian, and I'm happy to have this questionnaire or interview as you please. I'm more than happy to share my story.
All right, so we're gonna get going. Okay, so I want to start us off with hearing the story about how you came to live in the United States.
So I came to the U.S. I was made in Uruguay. My mom came pregnant, and I was born in USA. I'm Armenian descendant, so I have that three-way origin that I always say. So I am
So
American.
you have an Armenian citizenship? You have
Kind of. I
You're an
am Armenian
American
descendant
citizen because you were born
here.
here. Oh, but do they not give you like citizenship the way like I know like if you are born in like if you are European and you're born in America, you would have American citizenship. Does Armenia not do it that way, or does it not even matter?
When you're Armenian from the diaspora, it doesn't necessarily mean that you were born in Armenia.
Okay.
My grandparents were born in Armenia, but I consider myself Armenian as in culture. But from the citizen point of view, I am a U.S. citizen and a Uruguayan citizen because
Uruguayan.
at
Okay.
least.
Oh, right. Because Armenian is culture.
Exactly.
Uruguay is where you are from. So, what is, I don't know a whole lot about Uruguay. Like, is Uruguay mostly Armenian people? No?
No, so
Okay.
Uruguay is the place where my grandparents, surviving the genocide, took the first boat and it
Oh, okay.
landed in South America. So that's where my parents were born, and then they met and they emigrated to the U.S. When I was 11, we went to Uruguay. So most of
Okay.
my life, I lived in Uruguay, which is a Spanish-speaking country.
Right.
And I grew up in the Armenian community in Uruguay. So I lived 27 years there.
Wow.
And then I came back as an adult with no high school or college education in the system of US.
Oh, wow.
So I had to transfer and start a little bit over at the age of 37.
Wow. And what made you decide to come back here after being there for so long?
So there were a lot of changes in my life. And it was a good moment to things aligned for making that change professionally, from the personal point of view, from family situation. And so I always wanted to explore new horizons. I tried to go to Armenia first, but financially the economy wasn't working well and I had no one there.
Yeah.
So I have family here. My brother was living in New Jersey at the time. So it was the best fit with language and citizenship to start over as an adult in a more known land,
I
because it
see.
is very difficult to start a little bit from scratch.
Oh yes. Yeah, I can imagine. So I think this is a good time then for us to talk about your career path and how you ended up here. So I'm going to stop this and check this one. Okay. So I would like to know about what your career path has been like. I believe you were a teacher in Uruguay, right?
Yes.
So teaching and being in the studio at Pru is different, although similar in ways. So can you just talk me through what that path was and how you ended up knowing that this would be good for you?
Definitely. I had always an interest in arts and design, and my plan was to be an architect, so I did a
Oh,
year of
wow.
college there. It didn't go well. I'm not great at math
Yeah.
or statistics. So I tried industrial design. It was complicated back in Uruguay at the time. There weren't a lot of opportunities or a lot of private colleges that provided design options. So after a year of working and failed attempts to start a design career, I had a natural connection with children, and my mom's always worked with children as an assistant. So it was a great way to channel all that creativity through education. And for 9 years, I worked with preschool, pre-K and kindergarten, and then other 5 years in elementary school.
Wow.
So those years, pre-K education, there's more liberty and more art. So I did develop all that creative urge of through music and dance and singing and mural pieces and a lot of art. So you were allowed to have always your fingers dirty with paint and always came home with my clothes stained. And then I needed to keep on growing, and I didn't feel that being a principal was the role I was looking for.
Oh, so that would have been like the natural progression that
yes.
you kept going.
Yeah. So
that's like more administration and less teaching. Like, you wouldn't be like in the weeds with the kids. You look at it from like an operational perspective.
Exactly.
Which you didn't really want to do.
And I didn't want to grow that way, and so I was naturally doing graphic design work on the side as a volunteer for an Armenian organization, which is called Armenian General Benevolent Union, where I went to the school and then I worked as a school teacher there. Oh, by the way, all my teaching experience was in tenure positions in the public school.
Okay.
So in both pre-K and elementary levels. So I started developing naturally this interest in graphic design and all the school, you know, conference meetings, invitations were always directed to me. And then in the nonprofit AGBU, I would do photo exhibits and participate in things that naturally needed graphic design, and doing business cards and projects, templates. And so I took a course in graphic design, and then started thinking about seriously transitioning in my 30s out of teaching towards graphic design. And then when I came to the U.S., I started as a freelancer, of course, teaching kids and babysitting, and then teaching Spanish to adults while I went to school here at Montclair to get at least my bachelor's degree, and then continue with more design courses.
Did you do your degree at like an accelerated pace, or did it take you like the 4 years to finish your degree?
So they accepted most of my credits.
Oh, that's good.
90 credits out of a 4-year career.
Good.
So I was able to transfer, and then I completed my courses to achieve a bachelor's degree as soon as possible.
How did you feel? Were you on campus in classes? Like, you went to classes on campus? Because I go to school online. That's what we're talking for. I'm doing my master's at SUNY, and it's online. And I found that it's a different experience being in a classroom and being online. And I'm wondering if the experience was different for you going back to pursue a bachelor's. Like, did you find that the environment was a little difficult because the students were a lot younger than you? Like, what did you feel about that?
So going back to school is in a sense, but for me was going to school because I studied
in
a different language and a different system. And I was very interested in being in the classroom because I am a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm a learner too, and I am interested in that learning teaching process. And so being in a classroom with classmates and a professor is a different experience. However, the connection was a little bit different because of my age, because I'm a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
I am a little bit more demanding and request more because of that reason. But I did have an opportunity of remote training. In this transitioning out of teaching and into design / technology, I participated in a project that in Uruguay it's called One Laptop Per Child,
mm-hmm.
and it's a national program where there is one computer per child. And so this project was also exported to Armenia teach teachers how to use laptops, computers for the first time.
Oh, wow.
And then use it in their classrooms. And it was all in Armenian. So the second part of that training was remote.
Mm-hmm.
And I did experience that relationship from the teaching perspective,
mm-hmm.
And the importance of being very detailed and explaining a lot, because when it's remote, you need more words to get the message across.
Yeah, it's funny because a lot of people will say to me when I tell them, like, I'm doing my master's, and they'll say, oh, where are you going? And I tell them that, you know, I'm doing it online. They'd be like, oh, like, and you can't see my face because the recording, I'm making kind of like a grimacy face, and people will say, you know, oh, that's not real because you're not in the classroom with people. It's, you know, that's easy.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that sometimes it, I think, is trickier to do things remotely because of the communication. And, you and I, Val and I, work together. I oversee an arm of our team that works for Prudential, but they sit over in Ireland, and they started for us as digital ad traffickers, which was working in our system to get our digital ads out into the web sphere. But that's a pretty tedious, straightforward type of task that doesn't really give you a lot of growth. So we decided that it would be good to provide them growth opportunities and teach them things that could help them augment the studio, which Val manages now. So I hope for you it's been a good experience, because you've been able to kind of dip back into your teaching roots.
Definitely.
To be able to help them. And we also have the challenge of it being a remote experience because they sit over in Ireland. So maybe you want to talk a little bit about what you've enjoyed, what you think some of the challenges of working with Primerica are, and how that ties back to your teaching career.
Definitely. One of the things I mostly aim my focus on is communication and getting that message across, and also understanding what their feedback is.
Mm-hmm.
So when they're listening, that silence sometimes makes me a little bit nervous,
mm-hmm.
because I don't know if they're thinking, if it's hard, if they're like super happy, I can't see their faces,
right.
I don't know their expressions. And I believe that the teaching learning process needs a high level of connection for it to be a true learning experience.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, I'm just imparting a class.
Right.
And there's no guarantee that anybody's going to learn. So I want that communication to be strong. So every now and then I put a joke in there to see if they react. And then, you know, make the environment a little bit more cheerful.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, okay, you're still there. Let's keep on going. And then reinforce it in writing afterwards with emails,
mm-hmm.
and text messages or phone call, just to keep it fluent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I noticed that we also, in addition to it being the remote environment, we also have the challenge of it being a different culture, because even though, you know, they speak English the way that we do when we're training them, sometimes words are different. Sometimes the things that they say or the way that they say things, or, you know, I don't know what their background was like coming up as students. And I guess I was interested in that from your perspective. Like, what do you see as differences, like contrasts and similarities between the way children in Uruguay experience schools versus the way American students experience schools?
So I'm going to give a very broad answer, because
mm-hmm.
it's a very broad question.
It is, yes.
Yes.
And I mean, it could be your, you know, your experience, what you think. I don't expect you to.
Well, I'll go more to the cultural, general cultural aspect, the communication part.
Mm-hmm.
People in Uruguay, which is part of the Latin American culture, are mostly extroverted.
Mm-hmm.
And when you speak in a conversation, in a classroom with adults or children, whoever it is, naturally, spontaneously, people speak. And that entails to interrupt each other.
Okay.
And you feel that there's this dynamic dialogue.
And that isn't, like, people aren't taken aback by that. Like, they expect that that's going to be the dynamic of your conversation.
Yeah.
Like, they expect that everybody's going to be all contributing and talking, and it, like, nobody thinks of that as being rude.
Well, for example, in this moment right now, I have to hold my patience to not interrupt you, because I naturally just want to go and
yes.
tell you what I'm thinking about right now with my hands and all my facial expressions, and speak a little bit faster. But since that cultural transition between Latin America and the United States, I also tried to adapt, because probably when I got here, I interrupted more all
mm-hmm.
the time and didn't go directly to my point. So the way people express themselves in Latin America, they first give you context, where they're coming from,
mm-hmm.
and then they get to the point. So there's a little bit more of history background, and that's from a phone call, a simple conversation, a letter, or a book,
mm-hmm.
or an article. The way you write, the way you express yourself in Spanish, it's more about history, background, context,
mm-hmm.
and then you get to it. In English, at school and college, I learned, and then at work and with my husband, who's from Michigan, I learned that you have to first get to the point.
Right.
You have to be clear, concise, and then you develop. And then everything you develop has to keep on linking to the main clause. And so everything in that conversation, course, educational situation, is developed in the same way.
Mm.
So that, for me, is the first impression in the difference in the teaching-learning aspect.
Yeah, and it's interesting because, like, even from my experiences going to school here when I was little, I didn't go to preschool, but I went to kindergarten, and I remember kindergarten being, like, pretty free. Like, you could kind of do whatever you want. Like, the teacher would read us books, and we did have time where it was, like, now you're learning your colors, and we're going to color, and now we're going to sit here and listen to the teacher read. But a lot of it was kind of self-directed, and I think it was to transition you between, like, what it was like when you were home and what it's like going into school. But I think, and I'm seeing it with my nephews now and even my niece, it was different for them to go from kindergarten into first grade, because it was like first grade was so much more structured, and that's when it kind of went into the mode of, like, the teacher talks, you listen, you don't all talk at the same time, you're called on, like, don't blurt out the answer, like, if you know, like, my nephew, he will tell you what he knows, and he doesn't care, like, if someone else is telling, no, he wants to tell you, and that's not really accepted in American schools, so it's, you know, it's hard. I almost feel like I feel more, even though I'm introverted, I would be more drawn to the dynamic where you do have everybody contributing, because I think it's organic,
mm-hmm.
and it is a real conversation, whereas it's a little bit stilted when it's like, I'm going to call on you, I'm going to stop talking, and you can talk
yeah.
now, so if you want to interrupt me, I'm fine with that. So, and we're kind of meandering, and I think that's okay as long as you're
Definitely.
Good with the conversation. So you mentioned your husband is from Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me a little bit about how you met and what your relationship is like with him from a cultural perspective? Like, where have you had to adapt? Where does he adapt? And where might you, like, butt heads? Not, and don't get too
personal. No, don't worry. See, that's one thing I would easily get personal, but
and if
no,
you
no,
want,
no,
that's
no, fine.
I'm myself, I'm generally much more reserved than your average
uh-huh.
American, and I just grew up that way.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up expected to be very quiet. I had a very strict father and didn't grow up in the best environment, so I didn't really express myself a lot. So there are times when I'll hear people talk around me and I'm like, where am I? This is not like me at all, because I am usually reserved and I don't like to feel like people think I am prying.
Uh-huh.
So that's why I'm very conscious of, like, I don't want to be too personal, but you tell me whatever you want.
Okay, great. So with Dan, Dan Simon, my husband, we used to work together. He's also a designer.
Oh, okay.
And after a while, we met out of the work environment and started dating. And, you know, we had a lot in common,
mm-hmm.
and a lot to share. And then when the relationship started growing and feeling closer, your extended, your family,
mm-hmm.
Which for me, family is parents, my brother, cousins, uncles, second cousins, second uncles, all of that for me is family. I'm Armenian, so
yes.
We have the whole extended family as very close. And so he started, for example, someone that is Armenian in culture, when you get married to someone, you get married to their family too.
Mm-hmm.
So he started understanding and knowing how our relationship is and how close we are and how everybody knows everything,
mm-hmm.
and how we share a lot of things in common. And at the same time, I started knowing what a traditional American family is, which for me is only from the movies.
Yeah.
Thanksgiving, you know, everybody sitting on a table where the couples sat together. It's not like women on one side,
mm-hmm.
and men on the other. That for me is natural. So when it's like, oh, I get to sit next to my husband, and we all have one conversation. This is interesting. This is so civilized. And, you know, and everybody's talking about one topic.
Unless you start talking about politics or
yeah.
Well, but that's, sometimes those don't get so civil.
But
at least my first.
Yeah, you don't want to do that in any country. And so those were the cultural aspect was the thing that we first had to figure out and understand how the other side was, and then adapt to what you could, and then to other things be clear about, yeah, I don't understand this,
mm-hmm.
or he needs to understand what my point is or what my priority is, or be more structured and organized in my thoughts and how I conveyed them. And on the other side, I was asking him more flexibility,
mm-hmm.
changes last minute, getting late to places, and that all being loud, or, you know, poor thing, he has to be in a family meeting, a birthday, which we have one tonight, and everybody's speaking Spanish.
And he doesn't.
And he doesn't, and everybody knows how to speak English. And that can be rude, and that is rude, but...
Do you, like, tell him what people are
at
saying?
At the beginning, I was translating, and then I'm like, you have to learn Spanish because everybody wants you to be
right.
part of the conversation, but everybody's so happy to be with each other that it's like an effort. Even though, strangely, we are in the U.S., you would imagine people spoke English.
Mm-hmm.
So those things are the parts we have to work more on, the language and the cultural difference.
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting with today's political climate and it being
yeah.
very... charged towards immigration, and I feel like it's very anti-immigration now. It's interesting that you said, you know, you would expect people here from a different country to speak English, because I think that also is like your political background, kind of how you skew, because I feel like that's an unfortunate thing. Like, I wouldn't want somebody who moved here from a different country to feel like they should abandon their language,
mm-hmm.
and adopt English as like their only language, because I think your language is your culture and it ties you to your family. So it bothers me when I see a lot of cultural sentiments where there is anger against people in the U.S. who English is not their first language and they are still retaining their language. Have you had experiences with that at all, where you've had prejudice directed towards you? Like, what do you think about the current climate, if you're okay with
Oh, yes, definitely. It's very sad, the times we're living. We live in an area which is a melting pot,
mm-hmm.
and it's cosmopolitan.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's when I go to other cities in the U.S. and I don't see diversity, I'm surprised because I'm used to in the area we live in, and I take pride in that. And by the way, there isn't an official language for the United States. It isn't English.
Right.
It
right.
was under debate back in Benjamin Franklin's
right.
time. They wanted it all to be German. So the thing is that there isn't a official language, and we should take pride of diversity and everybody developing their cultures and being able to
yeah.
live together and in peace. And I probably was more as a child growing up, because back in the late 70s, 80s, it was something different. Since we speak Spanish, although being Armenian, we are categorized as Latins. Being Latin wasn't that out in the open, and it wasn't that accepted or cool or sexy.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like a second category.
Mm-hmm.
Today I see that shift. It's not the same. You can speak only Spanish and still today get along with your life. And there are a lot of successful people in the Latin community, but also in other communities. You know, we have now women in Congress,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, from different backgrounds and religions. So there is a certain growth. So that has changed from being a child in the 80s
mm-hmm.
to being now an adult. Speaking Spanish has other implications. But since my physical aspect isn't very, I dye my hair blonde,
yeah.
and so I have a lighter aspect, so they would never guess I speak Spanish. And so there is a difference when, on the contrary, I sometimes when I want to connect more with whoever is working, and usually in services or in places where I detect that they speak Spanish,
mm-hmm.
I prefer to speak to them in Spanish because there is this other connection. But I wonder, is that the correct way? Maybe this is, you know, not the way it should be. We should all speak in English, and that's the way it should be. Language also, when you're first generation, do you want to speak your language? Then with kids, it starts changing, and I see that in other
right.
People's families, that their kids understand the parents' language, but they respond back in English.
Right, right.
So that is very common, that the culture and the language of the family's origin starts assimilating to the
right.
to English.
Yeah, I mean, I have a hope now that we're seeing people of more diverse backgrounds coming into Congress, kind of resisting the current administration,
mm-hmm.
and I'm hopeful that
yes,
at election time
it will
turn around, and the benefit of like people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, like I hope that her contributions will kind of shepherd us back into a place where the melting pot is more accepted and moves us away from this climate right now, which just feels very negative to me, and you know, I just hope that things change.
We set back many ages.
Yes, and it's disappointing. So we have meandered a little bit. I will, as my computer just locked, I need to get back to the questions. So let's go back to work, and let's end, because we have about 16 minutes, so we can just be kind of freewheeling here. Let's talk about, out of the jobs that you have had, what was your favorite, what was your least favorite, and why?
I can say favorites because there isn't only one. In teaching, I had moments that I felt that it was an amazing experience to see when your student starts reading. It's a moment of magic. Or when you put a math situation that they have to process with logic, and the aha moment mm-hmm. when they figured it out, that's just beautiful. So those are the best moments mm-hmm. of that teaching job. Then you had to deal with administrative parts mm-hmm. and, you know, filling papers and
right.
writing and, you know, behavioral situations or time out for someone. Those things are the least favorite
yeah.
of the job. Or, you know, problems between children and then speaking with their parents.
Yeah.
That's the hard part. So I would be, that's the least favorite of teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And then those are the favorite ones. But also, from a general perspective, in design, when you feel that you accomplished a good idea
mm-hmm.
On your own path with feedback and with guidance, when you feel that you achieved what you were looking for, or even you surprised yourself with something,
mm-hmm.
that is also very satisfying. And I find that a lot in this job, with the current job I have. And the fact that I work with a great team, I have a great boss, I don't have any conflicts,
mm-hmm.
I feel respected, that is also part of, you know, the favorite job. Among the least, as the job itself entirely, I would say maybe babysitting, which I had to do.
I babysat too. This is a challenge.
Yes, because it took me nowhere. It was just the one thing. There was no developing a relationship. It didn't take me anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Or some sort of service job, like,
mm-hmm.
I don't know. I can't remember any, maybe, of those short-time jobs. But that would fill in the category.
Yeah. I worked a lot of different jobs before I came here, and I was in retail, and I'd have to say that's probably like my least favorite thing that I did, because I just find that when you're in a position like a service position,
mm-hmm.
you just see like the worst of people.
Mm-hmm.
I think people just really treat you like you're some second-rate person that is just there to make them happy, and you know, they hear the customer is always right, and they're
yes.
like, that means I can treat you like garbage. So it's nice when I came, and I didn't come here directly from service, you know, I bounced around a lot, but when I came here, it was nice because one of the things that Prudential is pretty big on is like respecting each other
mm-hmm.
and working together well, and I think we do that here for the
yes.
most part. And I think, you know, there are times when we drive each other crazy and
part
you know, and you have a bad day, but I think for the most part here, you know, we're all adults, we work together to our common goal, and we have our more good points than bad points.
Yep, I agree.
As we move across, and I think with working with the Primerica team, it's been fun to see them develop and see them like get things, and you know, they'll when you see them on one of the requests that it's like before you say something, they'll figure out how to fix it, and it's like, oh good. So my teaching experience was pretty limited. I like to teach people things, but the only time that I had a real like teaching position was I was an assistant for my psychology professor in statistics, because I took an independent study course, which is like you work with your professor to pretty much decide like what you want to do, how you want to get something out of this learning experience. So we talked about having me kind of nurture the more teacher side of me by taking on her statistics class. So she would like sit in the background and see how things were going and give me feedback. And you know, I would have this class, and it was a little intimidating because I wasn't very far from their ages. So it was kind of like, who is this person? But it was also nice because it was like you said, when you put up a problem and you see somebody like, oh, I know how to do this, it's really nice. But at the same time, I had kids that, like, would never come to class and, you know, that kind of stuff. It was like, oh, how do I deal with this and that, you know. And for a while, I thought that I might take the teaching angle, that I would stay with psychology and, you know, continue in, like, an academic track. But I didn't end up there because I saw it kind of being, like, what you were saying, where you're just moving towards the administrative and you move kind of away from the actual teaching.
Yeah.
So that's why my winding road took me here. So,
but I understand that perspective and that in-between moments between, you know, the satisfaction and the intimidation of what you have to work on. I had difficult moments in the schools I worked, because they were usually from low-income levels. In Uruguay, my last classroom was a container with windows.
Oh, wow.
And it was semi-rural.
Mm-hmm.
So I saw a lot of things, and students with, we didn't have any resources at school. We didn't have any special classes like gym.
Right.
We had to take care of everything, even singing. Everything was under the teacher's responsibility. So I saw a lot of poverty and that, how that affects a child. And that's the least, that's the most difficult part of the job. But also I had the experience of working with a, in graphic design, with an owner of a small print company that was more aligned to what our current president is. And that style of communication and dealing with things. So I got sick at that job and then ended up quitting, because that kind of stuff is what you really want to be far away from.
Yeah. Yeah,
so that's why I'm even more happy to be where I am right now.
Yeah.
Because I can compare, and I, even though sometimes some, I can even complain about, oh, this isn't working. Oh, Wi-Fi is so slow today. But if I scratch a little bit, you know, the surface, I remember where I came from, and everything has a different dimension.
Yeah, that's interesting, because, like, I remember I had to go through a time a couple years ago where I had to have a lot of medical tests. I had to have, you know, endoscopies and colonoscopies, like, pretty invasive tests, and I was very upset about them. I was like, I don't want to do this at all. Like, this is causing me actual, like, discomfort having to prepare for this. Like, I don't want to do this. And I realized at a point, like, I was like, I kind of need to stop being a baby about this, because I am privileged to live in a place where I can have those kind of things. And I think about other countries where, you know, they don't have access to hospital that has an MRI machine, and they might not have the preventative care like we have here. So it does put it into perspective, the things that you have that may seem annoying. Like, you might be like, oh, I can't get on the internet today, but then you think of a place where, like, they may not even know what the internet is. So, you know, it does definitely put it in perspective. It's interesting. We live in very interesting times. So I will wrap up by saying thank you very much. When I was thinking about people to interview, I thought you'd be a good candidate because you're one of the newer people on the team, even though you've been here pretty long. But, you know, I wanted to get to know more about you, because I think it helps people relate on a personal level when you're working together. You see people as people, not
of course,
just like
of
my
course.
Coworker that needs to get this done. So I really appreciate that you were able to be open and have this conversation with me. And when I write my memo, I will share it with you. And like I had told you, this recording will go on record with StoryCorps. I don't know that anyone will ever listen to it, but it was, I think we had a good conversation, and I have really appreciated it. So thank you for that.
Well, indeed, the pleasure has been mine. Thank you.
All right, so I think we are wrapped up, so we will sign off from Newark. So that is that. And if you have listened, thank you for listening.
Right.
All right. Bye-bye. All right. We have finished the recording.